From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, we talk with Jack Bergman, the Republican running for Congress from Michigan's 1st District.
It's up to us to work together and not play partisan politics.
A black student's thoughts about racist flyers on campus at the University of Michigan and the new diversity plan.
As a whole, the university has to do better with trying to target these instances.
What's behind a federal lawsuit filed by Native tribes around Petoskey? And the biggest haunted house in Michigan, Erebus, where you're guaranteed a good scare.
You know, over here we got things that will grab you, bite you, land on top of you. We're going to put you in a room, slam the door, fill it up 6 feet 6, and bury you alive. How long can you hold your breath?
Those stories and more. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. The most hotly contested congressional race in Michigan is widely viewed as happening in the 1st Congressional District. It covers the entire Upper Peninsula and a good-sized chunk of the Northern Lower Peninsula. Earlier this month on Stateside, Zoe Clark spoke with the Democratic contender, Lon Johnson. Today, we talk with the Republican candidate, retired Marine Lieutenant General Jack Bergman, with us now. General, welcome back to Stateside.
Hey, Cynthia, great to be with you today.
Good to have you here. Much of the talk, you and I talked the morning after you had won the primary, beat two veteran GOP politicians to win the nomination. And since then, as the campaign has unfolded, a lot of the talk about the race in the first was which of you has lived in the district the longest? And here's your opponent. He says you're not being truthful in saying you've lived in Watersmeet the full time since 2010. How do you respond to that?
Well, yes. I've lived in Watersmeet, but the point is, I don't even know how to respond to that, Cynthia, because it's so unimportant to the voters of the 1st District. The reality is, who fits? That's the question I think that the voters are asking now. Who's going to best represent us? Because if you look at the Constitution, what's the Constitution say? It says you have to live in the state.
Yeah, it's worth noting, according to the law, you are both qualified, you're both eligible to run and serve in Congress for the first. And so I do want to move to issues that really do affect people in your district. In your view, what are the biggest issues that voters in the first are facing and care about?
Well, you know, let's face it. You know, my dad left the UP in the mid-1920s because he couldn't find work as a young 18-year-old. And I would suggest to you in parts of the district today, the economy, jobs. That's what we want. That's what we need to be able to raise a family. Let's face it, I talked to a guy this morning who just said to me, oh, by the way, I just got my Blue Cross Blue Shield health care premiums and went from $36 to $233. We need health care that's affordable. And basically, we all want to get Washington, D.C. out of our way because we're the best stewards of our environment. We're the best stewards of our resources. We live here. We know why we live here. But Washington is overregulating and just in our way. So the bottom line is the economy, number one, from the perspective of the people of the 1st District. But, you know, from the larger perspective, stop spending all the money to take us deeper in debt. And, of course, the last piece of that is how do we combat the new national security issues that this country has? You know, we've got the SULACs, which need to be funded. The studies were done 30 years ago. It was approved, but then sidetracked. Other alternatives were there. We need to get the SULAC project funded because now it's not only a matter of the economy, it's a matter of national security. So that would be my first project that I would work on.
General, when I looked on your website and I went through the issues link with all of these issues that you see as very important in the race, the ones you've talked about and Second Amendment and moving the pro-life message forward and repealing Obamacare. So you've got a long list of issues that you're speaking out on. The one thing I didn't see was there was nothing about the environment or about the Great Lakes and Enbridge Line 5. And there were a number of people commenting on that page asking why. So what is your position on Line 5?
Well, the bottom line is Line 5, if it's not safe, if it truly is not safe, that has to be a decision that is made by the folks who understand the inspection process. And if it's not safe, you shut it down. If it is safe, you keep it open. But that's a decision that has to be made. But the safety, the waters, the environment are number one priority because that's our lifeblood in so many different ways. We cannot afford a spill or any kind of contaminants in the waters of the Great Lakes. So whatever it takes, that's what I would support.
General Bergman, you spoke with us the day after you won the GOP nomination. And at that point, we talked about whether you support Donald Trump. And certainly since then, we've seen Donald Trump in many of his statements dividing the Republican Party. Where are you today, General? Do you support Mr. Trump?
Well, let's look at the big picture of things here. Number one, at the top of the ticket, we have two candidates with flaws. But we have one candidate with fatal flaws, and that's Hillary Clinton, because of the fact I don't trust her. She has not performed. I would never vote for Hillary Clinton. Donald Trump is the man who needs to be the next president of the United States, and I'm going to vote for him.
What are your thoughts on being able to work with perhaps a president that you don't think should be there but has been elected?
I, as a Marine and as a business leader, I am a uniter, not a diviner. I will work across party lines and have worked across ideological lines. My job, my mission as a congressman is to represent the interests of the voters, the constituents of the 1st Congressional District of Michigan. There are 434 other congressmen and women who are going to do the same. It's up to us to work together and not play partisan politics. So if you keep electing people to Congress who all they've ever known is partisan, political, operative types of politics, and that's what they've done, then you're going to get more of the same. You're not going to get people who are willing to work across aisles.
This is your first time running for office, General. What have you learned from campaigning and talking to voters throughout the first that has surprised you?
One of the things that has surprised me is that how much people rely on the flat screens for their information without digging into the details to find out what's true. You know, there's a lot of stuff that's put out there that is just not true. And I feel sad for people who don't take the time to investigate when they hear something or read something. You know, is it true or isn't it? So, you know, I'm a data guy. I tend to take a lot of things, as my mother would have said, with a grain of salt until I can find out what it truly is, the truth. You know, what is the meaning behind the statement, et cetera, et cetera. So I would hope and encourage voters to look into, especially when it comes to voting, what attributes do the candidates have, so that when that successful congressman that's elected actually has the ability, the experience, the perspective, and the wisdom to actually go to Washington, D.C. and work for the constituents, not just work for a party.
Retired Marine Lieutenant General Jack Bergman, Republican candidate for the seat from the 1st Congressional District. Thank you so much for speaking with us on Stateside.
Hey, my pleasure, Cynthia, and make sure everybody votes on the 8th of November.
A treaty signed in the 1800s could dramatically change the political, environmental, and cultural landscape in northern Michigan. The Little Traverse Bay bands of Odawa Indians have gone to federal court and suing the state of Michigan. The tribes claim a treaty signed in 1855 declared a reservation for them on what is today 337 square miles of land and 103 miles of lakeshore. That land includes the cities of Harbor Springs, Petoskey, Goodhart, part of Charlevoix, as well as two islands in Lake Michigan. Here with more is attorney Jim Bransky of Traverse City. He represents the Little Traverse Bay bands of Odawa Indians. Jim, what is the tribe's claim in this suit?
I should make clear that the tribe is not trying to create a reservation or reestablish a reservation. All it's claiming is that just as the tribe has remained in its homeland from historic times through the present, even with all the more recent immigrants from Europe and other places, that the reservation that was reserved for the tribe in the 1855 treaty has also constantly remained. So the suit simply asks the federal government to recognize what we believe is the legal and historic reality.
Am I right that it was a 216,000-acre reservation that was created by that treaty in 1855? Is that not, in essence, taking this land and making it part of the reservation?
The reservation, we believe, has continuously been there since the treaty. Now, it's true that the land within the reservation has largely been lost to the tribe, and, you know, non-Indian governments have arisen within the reservation boundary. But that doesn't mean for the tribe's jurisdictional purposes that that boundary went away. Now, this lawsuit absolutely does not seek to threaten anyone's land title or the rights of local governments. The tribe is simply seeking to assert its own jurisdiction as a, you know, another layer. We all live within multiple jurisdictions. We live within cities and townships and counties, within states, within the United States.
I'm wondering what you say to property owners and officials and residents and business owners that lie within this affected area who perhaps are worried about a potential sea change in the way they live their lives.
Under the body of federal case law that's developed, there won't be a sea change. But the tribe feels the best way to address those uncertainties, instead of litigating this case for years and years, for the parties to sit down, similar to the way things proceeded in the Mount Pleasant situation with the Saginaw Chippewa tribe, and perhaps look at what's worked and what hasn't worked there in areas that still need to be covered, and really work out a mediated settlement that addresses all the things that people might be nervous about or that might be gray under the current law, like zoning, law enforcement, environmental protection. That could well be a much more effective use of limited governmental resources for everyone than litigating. But the reservation has extreme historic importance to the tribe, and that's why it felt necessary to bring this case.
Am I hearing between the lines that the tribe's overtures to local governments and haven't been received, but now that there has been a federal lawsuit filed, there's hopes that that might accelerate?
That would certainly be the hope on the tribe's end. I mean, the tribe is certainly prepared to litigate this case until the end. And at this point, the case has been divided by the judge into two phases. The first phase, just to determine if the reservation boundary legally exists. And then if the tribe prevails in that phase, future phases of the trial would focus specifically on what that means for particular situations.
So this certainly could go for quite some time through the courts.
Yes, and, you know, we have just let everyone know that we are perfectly willing to, you know, see if we can reach a mutually beneficial solution, and that the tribe is perfectly willing to sit down with all the parties and try to mediate long-term solutions to address any gray zones that people are concerned about.
Jim Bransky is an attorney for the Little Traverse Bay Bands of Odawa Indians. Jim, thank you so much for speaking with us and explaining the suit.
Oh, it was my pleasure.
Welcome back to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty, and it is now time to check in with Michigan Radio sports commentator John U. Bacon. John, the Paul Bunyan Trophy back in Ann Arbor in the hands of the Wolverines for the first time since 2012. Michigan's still number two in the nation at 8-0, while Michigan State slumps to 2-6. Was that game and the final score of 32-23 what you expected?
Not at all. I called it, I think, 42-7 before the game, and that was not an uncommon pick at that time. I thought that the Spartans would fight mightily in the first half and collapse for the second, and the exact opposite, Cindy, happened. So the first half was all Michigan. The last minute of the first half, they scored 10 points. So at that point, it's looking pretty bad, of course, for Michigan State. And in the fourth quarter, playing mostly for pride at that point, the game was not out of hand for Michigan. But they did fight back and put some points on the boards, 13 points, in fact, and good for them.
So what do you think as far as what we've seen of the Spartans so far? And, I mean, here we got now six straight losses, and they're 2-6. But what'd you see?
As expected, they gave Michigan their best game. Whatever they had, they threw at them. The defensive line got some pressure on the quarterback, Wilton Spate. Their offense, by the way, the first drive, they just marched down the field and scored a nice one. And then the backup quarterback, Brian Lewerke, looked very good in the fourth quarter. He's a freshman. And after the game, you're thinking, okay, obviously, with four games left, you put the freshman in, you get ready for the future. This season is basically a bust.
And what happens?
And what happens? You find out that Brian Lewerke has fractured his tibia. This is the season from hell for the poor Spartans.
Boy, oh boy. Who else did you like for State?
L.J. Scott was extremely effective as the tailback. And if you're a Michigan fan, maybe too effective, because he was slashing through Michigan's defense with great efficiency. So that's a very good sign for them, obviously. Malik McDowell is just a flat-out great player, and he was that day as well. On the Michigan side of the ball,
Gets the tip of the hat?
Wilton Spate is not going to make All-American teams. This is the quarterback. Mm-hmm. But he does not make mistakes. He's had three interceptions, one in this game, the entire season after eight games. I think 15 touchdowns or so with three interceptions. That's a great ratios right there. Mm-hmm. So what he is doing is not losing you the game. Not always winning you the game, but not losing it. He's got so many tools around him, he does not have to be the star.
And one of those tools is named Jabril Peppers.
Unbelievable. By the way, you might recall in 97, Charles Woodson became the only defensive player ever to win the Heisman Trophy. Jabril Peppers might be in that category, and he's scoring touchdowns at quarterback. He's returning punts and everything else. His numbers, defensively and offensively, right now, are better than Woodson's. He's not going to win it. He's not getting the attention you need for this. But he is right there.
What'd you take away from both sides, beyond the win and the loss, and looking into the future, let's say the next season or two, knowing who's coming up, what does Michigan need to work on?
The offensive line is still the weak point. I've been saying it all year long. They are good. On a good day, they're good. They have not been great yet. They're not probably going to be great, frankly. What they have to do is be healthy, because if you lose any one of those five guys, you have nobody left to fill in. What they accomplished is this. They won the game. I don't care if it's by 1 point. That's all Michigan needed. Two, they were healthy, no real injuries. Three, of course, their kicker, Kenny Allen, was 3 for 3 on field goals. He'd been struggling earlier. They're going to need him down the stretch. So for Michigan, they got almost everything they wanted out of this game.
We also have to just say hello, Broncos, number 17. They've moved up in the rankings. How high do you think they could go this season?
If they win out, they should be a top 10 team. Now, they got to win out, and you got to win the MAC title game as well, the Mid-American Conference. They've got a real chance at a January Bowl, which is a lot harder this year than it was in previous years. They've got a real chance. Right now, they're probably the second-best team in the state, I hate to tell you, Spartan fans, and they're moving up fast.
And what are the chances of Coach P.J. Fleck getting poached by another school, and how quickly?
I'm going to call it 100%. he'll wait till after the bowl game if they've got any class. And by the way, coaches always wait till after the bowl game. If you leave early, it leaves a bad taste in everyone's mouth, and now you've got less credibility with your new team also.
Michigan Radio sports commentator John Eubanks with words of wisdom for coaches. Thanks, John.
Thank you.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty.
The best and the brightest.
Opportunities.
The next idea.
We're going to find that these social and cultural factors really add a lot to economic growth.
Take funding from the Affordable Care Act. Add a $70 million state innovation model grant that was given to the State Department of Health and Human Services. And with that, you're about to see an ambitious new project that could change healthcare delivery in Michigan. It's called Michigan's Blueprint for Health Innovation. Our latest contributor to The Next Idea is the co-chair of this effort in Washtenaw and Livingston counties, one of five community innovation regions where this three-year project will be launching come January. Dr. Paul Valenstein, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Thank you.
What is this project really aiming to prove?
Well, we're trying to see if we can deliver care better for patients that seem to have both social needs and medical needs.
Just do a better job.
Do a better job by connecting social agencies with the healthcare system and by motivating people in the community to understand better when to use healthcare resources and when to use social service agencies.
Okay. Yeah, this is ambitious. So give us a sense then, if we're talking about better linking the healthcare system to social service organizations, what would this look like? I mean, what kind of organizations are we talking about here?
Well, let's first start with a problem. And we're focusing first on patients who go to the emergency department, the emergency room, frequently. So we have about 550,000 people in Washtenaw and Livingston counties. And the University of Michigan tells us there are about 600 people who have shown up in their emergency department five or more times in a year. If you talk to St. Joe's, which runs three emergency departments in these two counties, another 600 people come five or more times in 1 year to the emergency department. So that's an interesting problem, because almost nobody is so unlucky as to have five accidents that require them to go to the emergency department in a year. Something's going on. And if you look at the records of these folks, some patterns start to emerge. Some of them have substance abuse problems, more than you'd imagine. Many of them have mental health problems. Some of them are homeless. Some are hungry. Some of them just don't have the money to go see their regular doctor. Some of them don't have a regular doctor. So we're using a very expensive resource, the emergency department, for problems that we really think of as social problems. I didn't fully realize how expensive the emergency room is, but an average visit is going to cost somebody in society about $2,500. If that patient happens to get admitted for a medical reason, then society will end up paying $10,000 to $15,000 This is a very high-priced resource. It wasn't really designed to address social issues or mental health issues.
Homelessness,
so, yeah,
sure,
homelessness.
Sure,
sure. So that's what we're trying to get our arms around and see, is there some better way? Is this really the right way to go about it?
So what kind of system do you envision that will be in place with the launching of this program come January? How might things be different then in Washtenaw and Livingston County?
Well, we're still designing it. You don't get the whole story in this interview. You have to ask us back in a year so we can tell you exactly what we've done. And then you got to have us back in about 3 years mm-hmm. so we can tell you whether it worked. Because one of the requirements of this grant is that we look dispassionately at what we're doing to figure out whether it works. But I can tell you what we're thinking. We're thinking that we need to identify these patients before they hit the emergency department, because once they arrive, it's almost too late. So we're developing some predictive models that will tell us which of our 550,000 residents in Washtenaw and Livingston are highly likely to go to the emergency department multiple times. Obviously, having gone multiple times in the past is an indicator, but there are other hints that we think we can identify that will help us find a population that's worth looking at more closely.
And then get to them.
Then we're going to get to them. We're going to make an assessment because people aren't all the same. People have different issues. And we're going to try to connect them with the agencies that already exist that are better suited to deal with these problems. And we're also going to look at their peer support network because, frankly, what many of us do depends a lot on the attitudes of the peers around us. And so we're going to be asking ourselves, who are they working with, and are there peer coaches that we can link them up with that can give them a better sense of when to use the emergency department and when to use some other kind of resource?
Well, Dr. Valenstein, when you're talking about we, who's we? Who would be doing the looking and the identifying and the connecting?
Well, that's interesting. So this started as an initiative of IHA and the University of Michigan and St. Joe's and the Washtenaw Health Initiative. They got together to apply for this grant, and we're designing it together. But what we're not trying to do is build just one more infrastructure of care managers that sits in some silo and adds to our healthcare costs. So there's a lot we can learn from the internet and some of the new ways of doing business. And we're really trying to create a network of care managers who already exist in our community who can make some of these assessments and review some of these charts. Many of these people are the same people that are going to wind up on their desk anyway after they start using the healthcare system a lot. So if we can find an enriched sample of people that may not be interacting with the healthcare system and social service agencies in the best way, and we can enlist this network of care managers to tithe some of their time in reviewing these cases and getting them hooked up with the right agencies, maybe we can make a difference without creating a big expensive infrastructure.
And then if it does succeed, if this is something that you could say, yes, we have succeeded is the idea, then let's take it and spread it through Michigan?
Sure. So part of this model is a test. And part of the promise is that if the test works, it will be replicated. Mm-hmm. Another part of this conversation is payment reform. We, to some extent, have the healthcare system we pay for. And so in addition to hooking up patients with more appropriate services, we're trying to work with the payer community to pay a little bit more for care that is not utilized and maybe a little less for some types of care that are overutilized. Payment reform is always a difficult conversation, mm-hmm. but that's part of it too. And if we get the payment reform right, it will be easier to sustain this program if it works, because the kind of care that isn't being delivered now will be better funded.
The effort is called Michigan's Blueprint for Health Innovation. It'll be launching in January. Dr. Paul Valenstein is the Washtenaw Livingston County co-chair. This 3-year project will launch in Washtenaw Livingston counties, Jackson County, Genesee and Muskegon counties, and 20 counties in northern lower Michigan. So it should be a very interesting conversation 3 years hence to see how it has all worked out, Doctor. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Let's turn now to someone from the social service side of this equation. Aubrey Patino is with the Fuse Initiative led by Avalon Housing, the Fuse Initiative, the Frequent Users Systems Engagement. Welcome.
Thank you.
What is the Fuse Initiative?
Yeah, so Fuse is a program that's targeting high utilizers of emergency health systems who are homeless and have chronic health conditions.
So the ones the doctors call the frequent flyers.
Yes, yes. And we provide these individuals with supportive housing, which is essentially affordable, safe, decent housing, using what we call a housing-first approach, which treats housing as a basic human right, not a reward for clinical success. And we couple that sort of using housing as a foundation for recovery with pretty robust wraparound supports where we follow people into the community and provide care coordination to them.
So you've been, Fuse has been doing this for a while. So it seems to be it was a very good fit for the Michigan's mm-hmm. Blueprint program.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, people who are frequently using the emergency room as their source of care are typically costing all of our systems a tremendous amount of money. Mm-hmm. But most importantly, their quality of life is really suffering as a result. And when you compound that with the experience of homelessness, we know that we have to address that social determinant of health, that issue of housing instability, before we can expect that they'll be able to manage their complex medical needs.
Now, I know the program is being assembled and put together, the Michigan's mm-hmm. Blueprint for Health Innovation, and will launch early next year. But can you give us an idea? How will this program, working under this umbrella, be different from the way things are now?
Yeah. I think that the lesson that we've learned in working with this population is that it takes a specific commitment to serving them, and in order for us to break the cycle. And we don't want to duplicate what resources are already in existence, but we want to better leverage them. So traditionally, folks who are really hitting the EDs a lot.
EDs.
Emergency departments don't necessarily lack involvement of care providers. There are a lot of care providers involved, and the missing piece is really that care coordination piece. And so I think that's sort of the innovation in the state innovation models. How do we move out of the traditional medical model and really bridge that gap between social services and what happens on the medical side?
So in essence, one hand will know what the other hand is doing
yeah.
and can be just a lot more effective.
Yeah, that's the hope.
Aubrey, some people balk at the idea of just giving someone who's homeless some free housing or free services. Can you give us some examples or some numbers that kind of help us understand what it costs to provide these services compared to just leaving people alone?
Yeah, so we know anecdotally that it costs on average about $5,000 roughly per person per year to provide them with supportive housing. And we have participants in our program who cost our health system over $1 million in 1 year. So once the intervention took place, we know that their ED utilization dropped dramatically, for some to none at all, for some just once or twice in a year. So we can make some assumptions about cost avoidance there that we're hoping to really scale up through this intervention.
The challenge, I think, of a program like this, Aubrey, is finding the balance between helping the bottom line, so mm-hmm. dollars and cents, by targeting mm-hmm. these frequent ER users, the ones that are costing the most money in our healthcare dollars, and targeting the people who need the most help. What's the key to finding that balance?
From an ethical standpoint, that it's the right thing to do, but it's also making the business case, right? And that we have to do both things. And we know that that's sort of the innovation of what's happening around how we address complex issues like homelessness and high ED utilization. And so, I mean, I think that's why it's important that there's both a qualitative and quantitative component to how we look at this work, so that we're not just making the business case, which is important, but that we're also looking at how people's quality of life improved and what does that mean for the various mm-hmm. systems that they're touching, for the communities in which they live.
This demonstration project is using funding from the Affordable Care Act and then this $70 million state innovation model grant. And I know the idea ultimately is to take what you're going to be learning in Washtenaw and Livingston counties and making it kind of taking that information and sharing it with the rest of the state.
Yeah. Yeah. The goal is to scale it up And I think, you know, that's the interesting thing about social innovation is that there are a lot of demonstrations happening. How do we make those demonstrations sustainable? How do we replicate that? And I think that's, you know, that's sort of the hard work, even though it feels like the hard work is getting the program off the ground. Certainly with the FUSE program, that's been our task. We are one of four communities who are demonstrating that we can use supportive housing as a platform for recovery for this population. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the other communities are Los Angeles, the state of Connecticut, San Francisco, and us. And so we are all tasked with sustaining the work locally, but also helping to deliver this message so that other communities can replicate what we're doing. And I think that's in part how some of this is coming about throughout the state. And Medicaid expansion has played a really instrumental role in motivating that change process.
So taking what's happened and doing it better and for more people.
Yeah, that's the goal.
Well, it'll be interesting. Busy 3 years. And I know Dr. Valenstein was very clear. Talk to us in 3 years,
yeah,
and we'll see what we've really been able to accomplish, and then we can share with the state.
Yeah.
Well, we'll
yeah.
look forward to doing that. Aubrey Patino is with the FUSE Initiative, led by Avalon Housing. They'll be part of the upcoming 3-year project, Michigan's Blueprint for Health Innovation. Thank you so much for being with us on The Next Idea.
Thank you.
Support for The Next Idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Tensions are running high these days on the campus of the University of Michigan. Many minority students remain stunned, hurt, angry, days after racist flyers were found in two buildings on the U of M campus. One of the flyers called on Euro-Americans to be white and stop living in fear. Another flyer gave racist reasons why white women shouldn't date black men. University President Mark Schlissel called a community conversation meeting to let people express thoughts and feelings. And he released a university-wide diversity, equity, and inclusion plan. Some black student activists are skeptical. With us now is Lauren Ward, a sophomore at the Ross School of Business at U of M. Lauren, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Great to have you here. Now, am I correct that you are the only black woman in your business school class of 80?
You are correct with that, yes.
How about men?
There are no black men in my class.
You are the only black student
in my class.
Your class.
Yes.
Then give us your sense from where you sit as a student. What has been going on at the campus the last couple of weeks?
So to start, you have everything with the racist flyers going on. And honestly, I would say that that event was the tipping point for many black student activists on campus, many students of color on campus. That very same week, we had 3 deaths of unarmed black men that went completely unnoticed in class, that went unnoticed academically. And it kind of created this frustration with the disconnect that students had between academia and real life, because these are problems that affect students all the time. And so the primary frustration of coming from dealing with something like these flyers is just the frustration that the university was doing nothing about it. And events like this trigger more events, and they bring up other details such as microaggressions that have occurred on campus to students, me, my friends, everybody of all different ethnicities and different backgrounds. And so I think that these flyers were essentially just the boiling point. As soon as they surfaced, everybody immediately went, nobody knew what to think. Do we protest? Is this a school problem? Why were these posted on school campus? Was this a student? Were these outsiders? There was much confusion in the black community. And I think everybody's immediate response was to protest. Something has to be done about this. We've just had 3 deaths. We are tired emotionally. We have to go through school. And sometimes it becomes a sort of an issue because teachers expect us to still carry on with our weeks like nothing has happened. And so in Ross, we have sections, and that's kind of how we're grouped together. So we take our core classes as sections. So when I say my class, I'm only referring to my section. Mm-hmm. In the class of 2019, I personally only know of but maybe like 8 or 9 black students in my entire class of 2019.
And in your section, though, you are the only woman of color, person of color. Yes.
Correct. And when all of this, mm-hmm. these events took place, and then showing up to accounting, trying to learn debits and credits, obviously my mind's not there. So I think that was what the primary frustration with students regarding that specific event was. And that coincided with Schlissel's unveiling of the Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion Plan.
And I want to get your thoughts on that, but I want to circle back to your comment about the microaggressions that you and so many other students go through. Take us there. Give us some for instances.
For instance, it's like walking on campus and somebody sees your Michigan sweatshirt and they ask you, oh, do you go to Dearborn or Flint? It's stuff like that.
What about other groups? What do you hear from other groups?
So there's also been a few instances of Islamophobic instances on campus. And so they identify with us because we're in the same boat. I went to a speak out on Islamophobia on campus last year. There are hijabi women who are afraid to wear their hijabs on campus because of all the threats and dirty looks and just rude, despicable comments that get made to them. So it's not just a problem within the Black community. It's just, as a whole, the university has to do better with trying to target these instances. And I think part of that comes from a lot of the students on campus who aren't of color are from top 1%, wealthy, white neighborhoods, haven't really grown up in a setting where they would have to deal with an experience of diversity.
And vice versa.
Right, correct. So then some of the students mm-hmm. of color on campus, mm-hmm. they come from the inner city and they've never been in a classroom with white students either. So it's like two ends of a spectrum. And when you put these two different kinds of people together, they're going to clash because they don't have experiences with each other or they don't know what to do in a situation. So I think that's a primary issue on campus that really needs fixing.
With that in mind, what's your response to people who believe the kind of problems you're talking about are more of class rather than race?
I honestly think it doesn't have to do with class or race when it gets down to it. Essentially, this is a human problem because microaggressions are a form of bullying. And if you think about that on a really human level, just say you forget about race or you forget about class or you look at it exactly on the exact same playing field, it's just bullying. And they teach us that as kids. They say, don't bully. Bullying is wrong. Well, does it count as bullying if you're saying rude comments to a Black girl on her hair? Does it count as bullying if you're insulting a man named Muhammad because of his name? It counts as bullying, and people fail to realize that when they think of us as an angry mob of kids who are just pissed off all the time and just want to protest because we don't think we have equal rights and that we don't think that X, Y, and Z or... And it's just hard to explain to people like that who think like that because they're so contained in their own paradigms, in their own box, that it's just very hard to shift out of.
I'm speaking with University of Michigan student Lauren Ward, one of the Black students responding to racial tensions on the campus, including the racist flyers found in two buildings on campus. And we know that President Schlissel unveiled this university-wide diversity, equity, and inclusion plan. Do you think the plan will address the kinds of racist things you're finding on campus?
So the plan has been in the works for a few years, and student input has been a part of the plan, which is great. I'm very proud of that. I'm very happy that the university is accepting student input in this plan. However, I don't think that when the plan was created that it was meant to address these types of issues. When something so immediate pops up, like three deaths of Black men in the same week or racist flyers being on campus all in the same week, now, I understand that you can't address everything and you can't think of every single situation.
There's no one-size-fits-all solution.
Right, exactly. Right. But I've only read the executive summary of the plan that was on the DEI website that was made available. Now, details of the plan, like programs, how much funding is going into what, all the specifics, I haven't seen. And I don't even know if that's available to students. But that's something that probably should be made more aware if that is something that you want your students to really understand. So
I will note we've invited President Schlissel to come on the program. What would you like to say to him directly?
So I've spoken to President Schlissel about this issue a couple of times, and he assures me that everything is going well with the plan, that he's very excited to incorporate more student input with the plan, even now, in these days. I think that if I were to say anything to him, it's just to keep in mind what we spoke about at the union when he had this open community forum. I think that was very beneficial to letting him and faculty know exactly how students on campus were feeling, because I was very surprised that the majority of the faculty who was present at this event, they had no idea. And it's kind of like they had no idea what to do in the situation. They had no idea how to carry about it in classes. They had no idea how to even approach students about this. And it was kind of strange seeing all of that, because you grow up thinking, oh, these are my teachers, and teachers are seen as role models. And if you're teaching me, you're supposed to know it all. So when these things are happening and faculty and professors are coming up to me like, oh, well, that was a really, really inspiring speech that you gave. We had no idea that that was like as big of an issue as it was.
So it sounds like there's got to be more of that, because when you're in your circle, whether it's as a student or a faculty member, I guess it can be very easy to just fall into that wormhole and not realize it. So that had to have been an enlightening moment for a lot of people.
It was. It was enlightening for me. Mm-hmm. It was enlightening for them. For example, the Dean of Ross was at that meeting. He came up to me after and told me that he had no idea that any of this was going on, that students were feeling unsafe on campus. He told me that he was moved to tears by some of the stories that he was hearing about students who were afraid to even remain on campus after classes were done. They go home, they go to class, they go back home because they're afraid to even associate with anybody else. Because when the Black community's not there, they don't know who's safe, given all the events that happen in the community and nobody addressing them. And he was very enlightened by that too. And I think that inspired him to hold his own session that he had at the Ross School a couple days following Schlissel's. So that was a very interesting moment.
It sounds like I hear you say, well, it's a good start, but then what?
Yeah. So it's a great start. Yeah. And I think personally, because I'm a student at Ross, I know Ross's plan a little bit better, just because Scott has taken the initiative to make himself visible, to make himself an ally.
Scott being?
Scott Giroux, the Dean of Ross. Mm-hmm. And he told me, he said, Lauren, I really appreciate your activism and your efforts on this issue and trying to bring everybody in to make sure that we resolve this problem. So then a couple of days following our little small community Ross forum that we had with Scott, he sent out an email outlining all the ideas and everything that we had talked about in our session, and then sent it out to all the students and faculty of Ross and said, this is what we need to do. This is what we're working on. These are the ideas that we came up with. If you have any input, please let me know. We can help outline all of these things. And it was just very good that he made himself visible. And I think part of that is being proactive. A lot of the students were upset with Schlissel because after the racist flyers came out, it took 2 days for the university to put out a statement, and it didn't seem very genuine in the eyes of most.
Right now, Lauren, would you recommend, if you had friends or family members who were deciding on a college, would you encourage them to come to Michigan?
I would. I would encourage them to come to Michigan. I think Michigan is a beautiful place. Michigan is a great place. I'm just as involved in football games, in student life. I'm in the union every day. I know the victors by heart. This is my school. This is my home. It's frightening, though, when this place that I consider a home to me doesn't really support me like I want it to. So with the Flyers, it kind of gave me a second, like, well, I've been immersed in this, and this is something that I love, and I love this place to death, but do they love me? Is kind of the disconnect that I'm going through. And I know a lot of my friends feel the same way, which is why it's very easy for us to react in a flight response rather than fight. Now, when people reach out like Hillel, a Jewish organization on campus, or when the Muslim students reach out to the director of DAIS, which is the Department of African American Studies on campus, expressing letters of solidarity and emotion, and that they understand what we're going through, and if we need anything, then they're always there for us. It's stuff like that that makes us feel better on campus, and it's stuff like that that makes me stay at Michigan and call Michigan my home.
Lauren Ward is a sophomore at the Ross School of Business at the University of Michigan and one of the University of Michigan's Black campus activists. Lauren, thank you so much for speaking with us today, and we will remain in touch with you as this evolves. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Join us tomorrow as we speak with University of Michigan President Mark Schlissel. He'll talk about the school's diversity, equity, and inclusion strategic plan.
you know, our need to improve the quality of the experience for all our students doesn't begin in 5 years. You know, it begins yesterday.
That's tomorrow afternoon on Stateside. To many in Southeast Michigan, it just wouldn't be Halloween without a haunted house. One estimate figures there are 70 to 100 haunts within just a 50-mile radius. The granddaddy of them all, in fact, the biggest in Michigan, one of the biggest in the world, is Erebus, a four-story building in downtown Pontiac. It's been scaring people silly for 17 years now. Ed Terribas and his family own Erebus, which we should note is a Greek word, the personification of darkness in Greek mythology. Ed, what a great name.
You know, it's kind of awesome name just because you put a T in front of it, you get Terribas, and that's my last name. So it was almost like we were destined to do this kind of stuff.
What brought you into the business of haunting?
You know what? This goes back 37 years. My brother was actually working with the JC chapter, and they went out of business. And he was working with Ford's. He ended up getting laid off from Ford's and said, you know what? I'm going to build a haunted house. My brother's 10 years old, and I was. I was graduating high school at the time. I said, that sounds like fun. And we proceeded to build a haunted house in his backyard. We assembled it in front of Kmart's in a parking lot. And we charged $1.50, and it was 1,200 square feet to go in.
And now you have this four-story behemoth right in downtown Pontiac. Tell us about the building that you bought for Erebus.
The building is 113,000 square feet.
And how long does it take to go through and be terrified?
The length you're walking is over a half mile inside the building. It's over 2,600 linear feet. It will take you anywhere from 35 to 45 minutes. Depends how fast you're running.
And how many actors do you have?
We have approximately about 100 actors in here every night.
And I suspect there's probably a great need for throat lozenges because there's probably a lot of screaming both from the customers and from the actors.
So you know it. You know, I mean, it's a... At the end of the month, we were definitely beat up and tired, especially this. You know, we opened up on the 19th, and from the 19th, we were open every day till October, or, you know, Halloween here.
How many people go through in an average year?
Tens of thousands.
What is it, do you think, Ed? Why do you think people pay you to scare them? The bigger the scare, the better.
You know what? I mean, it's being scared in a safe, insane environment, maybe sometimes insane environment, where you know it's all about fun. So it's kind of like watching a scary movie, but instead of watching a movie, you're actually engaging in a movie because, you know, over here we got things that will grab you, bite you, land on top of you. We're going to put you in a room, slam the door, fill it up 6 feet 6, and bury you alive. How long can you hold your breath? So, I mean, in knowing that that's going to happen, but you're going to be able to walk out of the end and everybody's going to laugh and giggle about it, and you get to watch your friends to see who – I mean, we have a board, you know, keep track of the wimps and the wetters. So now you get to watch your friends and see who's a wimp and who's a wetter, you know?
The wimps and the wetters. We get it. Now, I know you design and build all the attractions within the building. What part are you most proud of?
You know, I like the my little mutant gorilla guy. I like him because he comes out and grabs you. We were able to create a swamp, artificial water inside a haunted house, which is a phenomenal effect. And then also our Buried Alive, where we put you in there and bury you alive. We spent 6 years working on this thing before we could put it in a haunted house.
So it's worth it. It's worth it, huh?
Yeah. I mean, over here, you're going to see things you've never seen before in a haunted house, which is pretty cool. You know, I mean, unfortunately, there's a lot of haunts out there, and they got the same stuff from 1970. I think that's the reason why some people stop going to haunted houses, because they see the same thing over and over again, where, you know, you come here, you're going to definitely see something different.
What's the best thing about the day after Halloween for everybody on the crew?
I think a little bit of sleep.
Ed Terribas, you can check out pictures and video of Erebus by going to hauntedpontiac.com. Happy haunting, and thanks so much for being with us, Ed.
Have a happy Halloween.
And today's Stateside for Halloween was directed by Mercedes Mejia and engineered by Bob Scon. Our executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. I'm Cynthia Canty. Happy Halloween, and thanks for listening.
Support for the next idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.